Oliver had not been within the walls of the workhouse a quarter of an hour and had scarcely completed the demolition of a second slice of bread when Mr. Bumble, who had handed him over to the care of an old woman, returned, and, telling him it was a board night, informed him that the board had said he was to appear before it forthwith. Not having a very clearly defined notion of what a live board was, Oliver was rather astounded by this intelligence, and was not quite certain whether he ought to laugh or cry. He had no time to think about the matter, however, for Mr. Bumble gave him a tap on the head with his cane to wake him up, and another on the back to make him lively, and, bidding him to follow, conducted him into a large whitewashed room, where 8 or 10 fat gentlemen were sitting around a table. At the top of the table, seated in an armchair rather higher than the rest, was a particularly fat gentleman with a very round red face.
"Bow to the board,"
said Bumble. Oliver brushed away 2 or 3 tears that were lingering in his eyes, and seeing no board but the table, fortunately bowed to that.
"What's your name, boy?"
said the gentleman in the high chair. Oliver was frightened at the sight of so many gentlemen, which made him tremble, and the beadle gave him another tap behind, which made him cry. These two causes made him answer in a very low and hesitating voice, whereupon a gentleman in a white waistcoat said he was a fool, which was a capital way of raising his spirits and putting him quite at his ease.
"Boy," said the gentleman in the high chair, "listen to me. You know you're an orphan, I suppose."
"What's that, sir?" inquired poor Oliver.
"The boy is a fool. I thought he was," said the gentleman in the white waistcoat.
"Hush," said the gentleman who had spoken first. "You know you've got no father or mother, and that you were brought up by the parish, don't you?"
"Yes, sir," replied Oliver, weeping bitterly.
"What are you crying for?"
inquired the gentleman in the white waistcoat. And to be sure, it was very extraordinary. What could the boy be crying for?
"I hope you say your prayers every night," said another gentleman in a gruff voice, "and pray for the people who feed you and take care of you like a Christian."
"Yes, sir," stammered the boy. The gentleman who spoke last was unconsciously right. It would have been very like a Christian, and a marvellously good Christian too, if Oliver had prayed for the people who fed him and took care of him. But he hadn't, because nobody had taught him.
"Well, you have come here to be educated and taught a useful trade," said the red-faced gentleman in the high chair. "So you'll begin to pick oakum tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock, added the surly one in the white waistcoat.
For the combination of both these blessings in the one simple process of picking oakum, Oliver bowed low by the direction of the beadle, and was then hurried away to a large ward, where, on a rough, hard bed, he sobbed himself to sleep. What a novel illustration of the tender laws of England! They let the paupers go to sleep. Poor Oliver! He little thought, as he lay sleeping in happy unconsciousness of all around him, that the board had that very day arrived at a decision which would exercise the most material influence over all his future fortunes. But they had, and this was it. The members of this board were very sage, deep philosophical men, and when they came to turn their attention to the workhouse, they found out at once what ordinary folks would never have discovered. The poor people liked it. It was a regular place of public entertainment for the poorer classes, a tavern where there was nothing to pay, a public breakfast, dinner, tea and supper all year round, a brick-and-mortar Elysium, where it was all play and no work. "Uh-huh," said the board, looking very knowing.
"We are the fellows to set this to rights. We'll stop it all in no time."
So they established the rule that all poor people should have the alternative, for they would compel nobody, not they, of being starved by a gradual process in the house or by a quick one out of it. With this view, they contracted with the waterworks to lay on an unlimited supply of water, and with a corn factor to supply periodically small quantities of oatmeal, and issued 3 meals of thin gruel a day with an onion twice a week and half a roll on Sundays. They made a great many other wise and humane regulations, having reference to the ladies, which it is not necessary to repeat, kindly undertook to divorce poor married people, in consequence of the great expense of a suit in Doctors' Commons, and instead of compelling a man to support his family, as they had theretofore done, took his family away from him, and made him a bachelor. There is no saying how many applicants for relief under these last two heads might have started up in all classes of society if it had not been coupled with the workhouse. But the board were long-headed men and had provided for this difficulty. The relief was inseparable from the workhouse and the gruel, and that frightened people. For the first 6 months after Oliver Twist was removed, the system was in full operation. It was rather expensive at first in consequence of the increase in the undertaker's bill and the necessity of taking in the clothes of all the paupers which fluttered loosely on their wasted, shrunken forms after a week or two's gruel. But the number of workhouse inmates got thin as well as the paupers, and the board were in ecstasies. The room in which the boys were fed was a large stone hall with a copper at one end, out of which the master, dressed in an apron for the purpose and assisted by one or two women, ladled the gruel at meal times. Of this festive composition, each boy had one porringer, and no more, except on occasions of great public rejoicing, when he had 2 ounces and a quarter of bread besides. The bowls never wanted washing. The boys polished them with their spoons till they shone again, and when they had performed this operation, which never took very long, the spoons being nearly as large as the bowls, they would sit staring at the copper with such eager eyes as if they could have devoured the very bricks of which it was composed, employing themselves meanwhile in sucking their fingers most assiduously, with the view of catching up any stray splashes of gruel that might have been cast thereon. Boys have generally excellent appetites. Oliver Twist and his companions suffered the tortures of slow starvation for 3 months. At last, they got so voracious and wild with hunger that one boy, who was tall for his age and hadn't been used to that sort of thing, for his father had kept a small cookshop, hinted darkly to his companions that unless he had another basin of gruel per diem, he was afraid he might some night happen to eat the boy who slept next to him, who happened to be a weakly youth of tender age. He had a wild, hungry eye, and they implicitly believed him. A council was held, lots were cast who should walk up to the master after supper that evening and ask for more, and it fell to Oliver Twist. The evening arrived, the boys took their places, the master, in his cook's uniform, stationed himself at the copper. His pauper assistants ranged themselves behind him. The gruel was served out, and a long grace was said over the short commons. The gruel disappeared. The boys whispered each other and winked at Oliver, while his next neighbours nudged him. Child as he was desperate with hunger and reckless with misery. He rose from the table and, advancing to the master, basin and spoon in hand, said, somewhat alarmed at his own temerity, "Please, sir, I want some more." The master was a fat, healthy man, but he turned very pale. He gazed in stupefied astonishment on the small rebel for some seconds, and then clung for support to the copper. The assistants were paralysed with wonder, the boys with fear.
"What?"
said the master at length in a faint voice.
"Please, sir," replied Oliver, "I want some more."
The master aimed a blow at Oliver's head with the ladle, pinioned him in his arm, and shrieked aloud for the beadle. The board were sitting in solemn conclave when Mr. Bumble rushed into the room in great excitement, and, addressing the gentleman in the high chair, said,
"Mr. Limpkins, I beg your pardon, sir, Oliver Twist has asked for more."
There was a general start. Horror was depicted on every countenance.
"For more?" said Mr. Limpkins. "Compose yourself, Bumble, and answer me distinctly. Do I understand that he asked for more after he had eaten the supper allotted by the dietary?"
"He did, sir," replied Bumble.
The boy will be hung, said the gentleman in the white waistcoat. I know that boy will be hung.
Nobody controverted the prophetic gentleman's opinion. An animated discussion took place. Oliver was ordered into instant confinement, and a bill was next morning pasted on the outside of the gate, offering a reward of £5 to anybody who would take Oliver Twist off the hands of the parish. In other words, £5 and Oliver Twist were offered to any man or woman who wanted an apprentice to any trade, business or calling.
I never was more convinced of anything in my life, said the gentleman in the white waistcoat, as he knocked at the gate and read the bill the next morning. I never was more convinced of anything in my life than I am that the boy will come to be hung.
As I purpose to show in the sequel whether the white waistcoated gentleman was right or not, I should perhaps mar the interest of this narrative, supposing it to possess any at all, if I ventured to hint just yet whether the life of Oliver Twist had this violent termination or no.